In the name of one God, creator, redeemer, and sustainer of our lives, amen. I'll ask you guys the same question. What is faith? And hopefully you'll have more responses than they did. I don't know if there's a right or wrong answer. Yeah, definitely. Putting things into the hands of God. Great. Tootie. Belief in something you may not be able to see. You guys are good. Belief that God really is there. Embracing mystery. I like it. Courage to let go. Anybody else? Yeah, Randy. The opposite of certainty.
Surrendering to a truth that cannot be understood.
Surrendering to a truth that cannot be understood. This seems a mystery. Letting go. I mean, some of these are surrendering, letting go. They're action words. Some of them are more thought words. Belief in our system. For me, growing up as a kid, belief, faith meant kind of intellectual assent to certain doctrines or dogmas, and you had to kind of get on board with those doctrines and dogmas if you wanted to believe or be part of this particular church. And then as I grew older, I came to understand faith as a way of orienting yourself or following in a path. Good, great. I mean, I think that faith is something that as people on a spiritual journey, it's a lifelong process trying to figure out what is faith. How do I step more deeply into faith, and what does faith mean to be? I want to reflect on faith in the context of these three passages that we read, because I found myself disagreeing with Paul, which I think we misunderstand Paul, but I don't think I misunderstand him here. He's in this discussion, and he wants to emphasize the righteousness of faith, whatever that means, the righteousness of faith. Right, so he pulls up Abraham and brings Abraham into the story to talk about faith and what a great exemplar of faith Abraham was, right? That hoping against hope, he believed he would become the father of many nations. And he did not weaken in faith when he considered his own body, which was already good as dead, which was about 100 years old. So he did not weaken in faith when he said, when he considered that he was 99 years old and about to have children. Really? Really? No distrust ever made him waver concerning the promises of God. He did not weaken when he also considered the barrenness of Sarah's womb. No distrust made him waver concerning the promise of God. That's actually not what the story says. And it's curious to me that the story is in Genesis 17, but our lectionary, the people who put the lectionary, cut out all the juicy bits. Like it's Genesis 17, 1 through 7, and then 15 through 16, and we didn't include any of the parts that would have disagreed with Paul. And so I want to just rehash that story a little bit. Abraham is 99 years old. God has made him a promise, a covenant, and this is it's about covenant and making covenants. God, you know, we talked about covenant last week when we talked about the story of Noah and how God, in God's anger at the disruption of God's good creation, decided to destroy God's good creation through this flood and then makes a promise never to do that again. God repents, and God makes a promise never to do that again and puts a rainbow in the sky. And God makes a covenant with humanity and with the animals. In chapter 15, God first shows up to Abraham and makes a covenant and says, I will be your God and you will be my people and I will make your descendants as numerous as the stars of the sky. And there's this weird thing where they've got animals on the ground and they cut them in half and God kind of walks through the animals. It's a weird passage. We don't read it very often in church. But that's this first covenant. And then chapter 17, God shows up again to make a covenant. A covenant is the divine limiting itself or making a commitment, a promise to God's people in a relational dynamic gets set up. And that's what a covenant is. It's primarily about this relational dynamic between God and humanity, or the divine and humanity. And so God makes this covenant with Abraham, who is 99 years old. He's got one kid, but it's not through Sarah. I mean, he got this kid because Sarah felt bad about the fact that they weren't having children. And so she says to Abraham, hey, why don't you sleep with my servant girl, Hagar? And maybe that way you can have a son. And so Abraham does. And Sarah gets jealous and makes life difficult for Hagar. And Hagar flees into the wilderness, where she's met by an angel. And the angel encourages her and saves her and makes God's, lets her know that God actually sees her. And so she goes back. And so now Abraham is 99 years old. He's got one kid, but he doesn't have these numerous descendants. And God shows up again and says, hey, I'm going to make a covenant with you, and I will make you a father of many nations. And Abraham falls on his face, which is a detail that we let slide and don't consider, because I think most of us are not in the habit of falling on our faces anymore. Used to be back in the day, you would fall on your face when you were, I guess, in awe. I don't know when the last time any of you fell on your face was out of awe, but you know, it's kind of a profound, you're prostrating yourself, basically. I mean, it's a very profound somatic act to kind of fall on your face. So here Abraham is falling on his face in the presence of the divine. And God says, I will make a covenant between you, me, and you will be a father of many nations. And your part of this covenant is, I want you to circumcise yourself. And I want you to circumcise all of your male children, and all of your slaves, and servants, and everybody who is in your household. Let them be circumcised, and anybody who's not circumcised will be cut off from their people. Like, we cut that part out of the text, curiously, because it's awkward to talk about in a sermon in front of people. Well, children might be present, right? And it's a little bit too graphic. Like, and I think we do a disservice to ourselves by doing that, because it says something profound. I mean, often when you've had this, when I was in Africa, I spent a number of years in Africa, and the boys would go through a rite of passage. I mean, I actually saw circumcision as a part of one of those rites of passage, so it's still practiced as a rite of passage. But often people would scar themselves. Like, you'd see men with scars on their faces that were symbolic of being eaten by the beast or the animal, you know, that then, and they then came out alive. So it was a symbolic sense of the rite of passage, right? There are some fraternities that, you know, would brand themselves with a hot iron so that there would be a scar, right, as a rite of passage. There are ways that people have of marking their bodies to show, you know, this profound shift, you know, this gestalt shift or this profound ontological shift in your being around who you are. You become somebody new. And God says, hey, I am going to be your God, and you're going to be my people. And I want you, at least the men, because this is a patriarchal system, which is why the focus is on the men, and maybe to the women's benefit in this instance. But anyway, I want you, the men, to mark your body. And we're going to mark you at the core of your own sense of yourself as a man. And what's being cut is the penis, right, if you think about it. And so the core of a man's kind of sense of himself as a man, a sense, his sexuality, his reproductive capacity, God is saying, I will mark, I want you to be marked all the way down to your, the core of who you are as a man. That's the sign. So it's a profound, actually, act. I mean, we don't take it as seriously anymore, but symbolically, it's a profound act to say, I will be your God, and you will be my people, and this is how you will know you'll be my people. You will be marked at the very basis of your sexuality. And it's something to think about, right? It's something to ponder. And that's what God says, I will be your God, you will be my people. And so And then God says, I will change your name from Abram to Abraham as a sign of this transition. A name change is often associated with profound reorientation in the world. And then God says, after he talks about circumcision, he says, and for your wife Sarai, you will name her Sarah, because I am making this covenant with her too. And when, after God says that, I am making this covenant with Sarai, she's going to be the mother of these nations, Abraham falls on his face again. That's verse 17. We didn't read that part. But he falls again on his face and he laughs. I mean, we're all familiar that Sarah laughs. She laughs later. But he laughs because he's like, seriously? She's 90 years old. And I'm 99. Right? He doesn't have any sense that, yeah, this is really going to work. And he says, hey, can you take Ishmael instead? Why don't you take Ishmael? Because I already have a son. Use him. So, and again, it's curious to me that in that moment, in the first moment where he had this profound sense of awe and he falls on his face before God, but then he has this profound moment of doubt and disbelief and he falls on his face laughing before God. There's these two falling of on his faces that happen in the text, right? Is it possible that somehow they're connected? Like his doubt, I mean, Paul misreads this whole passage because he wants to highlight Abraham's faith, but, you know, in doing so, Paul overlooks what really is Abraham's doubt. And I think he does a disservice to us as people of faith. Paul does a disservice to us as people of faith because, gosh, if Abraham could, in that profound moment, has doubt, Sarah later is going to doubt and she too will laugh. And so they name their son Isaac, which means he laughs, to commemorate this moment where God made a promise to them and they doubted the goodness of God. That's what they're doubting, is the goodness of God. And I think that often is at the core of our doubt. Is God really good? Is God really for us? Does God even care? I mean, that's what's at the core of, is God there, whether or not there's a God or not. I think at the core of it is not just the existence of God. It's actually, is there good there? Is there love there? That's what we doubt. Is there really love at the core of all being? And does that love love us? That's our doubt. What Abraham does do is he goes and circumcises himself, and he has all the men in his family circumcised, and he marks himself and his family despite his doubt. Which gets us to today's passage, today's gospel text. We read a couple verses before what's in the lectionary, because Peter, I mean, it's Peter's confession of the Messiah. I mean, Jesus and his disciples are at the northern end of Israel's territory, or what was Israel's territory at that time, and in Caesarea Philippi, which was, there was a shrine to the god Pan here, a famous shrine. So there's this pagan shrine to the god Pan, and there Jesus is standing with his disciples in the midst of this shrine. There's a grotto and a spring of water there, and he's saying, well, who do you say that I am? And they're like, some people say you're Elijah, some people say you're the John the Baptist. He says, who do people say that I am? And then he says, well, who do you say that I am? And Peter says, you're the Christ. You're the anointed one. You're the one we've been waiting for. You're the one that will be the sign of God's salvation for us. And Jesus says, good on you, right? Blessed are you. Don't tell anyone. And then we get to today's gospel text, what should be today's gospel text, where he then starts teaching them that the Son of Man, this anointed one, this Messiah, should suffer and be rejected by the religious leaders and die, and then on the third day rise again. And when Peter hears this, he rebukes Jesus. He says, no, shut up, stop. Like, rebuke, it's a strong movement towards Jesus. He's trying to shut Jesus down. Because he can't, for whatever reason, that to suffer, to be rejected, to die, I mean, even to rise again, shut up. Seriously? And Jesus, I mean, we can only imagine, we're left to imagine what Peter is feeling in that moment, why his impulse is to say to Jesus at that point, no, I can't tolerate that, I can't hear that, that's not what I want you to be about, that's not the image I have of you. That's not what I signed up for. As your follower, that's not what I signed up for. Suffering, rejection, crosses. Shut up. And Jesus looks at his disciples and he says to Peter, and he rebukes Peter. Peter rebuked him, he rebukes Peter, and he says, get behind me, Satan. Which is me baffling. How does Peter go from being this guy who has insight into Jesus being the Messiah to being equated with Satan? Like, how can you at one moment have such profound insight and faith, and at the next moment, Jesus is calling you Satan? How does that feel? How does that feel for Peter? I imagine it's devastating. And then Jesus says, if you want to be my followers, you have to take up your cross and follow me. Whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. And whoever tries to save his or her life will lose it. What does that mean? Like, what does it mean to take up a cross? And, you know, however symbolically, what does it mean that Jesus is saying, if you want to follow me, you've got to take up a cross, and you've got to lose your life if you want to find it? Like, this paradox. I'm still trying to figure that out. I wish I could give you a good answer. It's probably best that I don't give you a good answer. Because I think that's part of our own journeys, is we're all figuring that out for ourselves. I know for myself, when I was in my 20s, I went through this profound period of agnosticism where, you know, I'd grown up in a conservative Lutheran church where we were taught that the Noah's Ark was real and, you know, there's a six-day creation. And, you know, I got to my college and I realized, oh, the teachings of my childhood, the faith formation I had in my childhood, actually didn't equip me to encounter the reality of the world. Or didn't equip me to kind of encounter the kind of some of the truths that were present in the world. And so that began a crisis of faith for me, where I wasn't sure I believed in God anymore. I wasn't sure I could trust that the God I had been introduced to as a child was real. I didn't know if I could give intellectual assent to these doctrines or dogmas. And that was really disorienting and destabilizing for me, as you know, in college, at a time when you're trying to figure out other things and you've got your own sense of, you know, trying to make your way in the world, and the world is a big place and you realize the world is bigger than you actually have capacity for. And it was hard, right? It was profoundly hard and difficult to be without any kind of the mooring I had around faith, to kind of be uprooted and then to have to be left wandering in the world, wandering about these things and not having that thing, anything I could really put my faith in. I still went to church, though, for whatever reason. I just did. And I argued theology with my friends. But these verses, of anything in the Bible, I didn't really read my Bible, but of anything in the Bible, these verses somehow I clung to. I liked these verses. And I think I liked these verses because there was this admission, I mean, there was a sense of my life at that point sucked, actually, quite honestly. I wasn't loving life. And so the notion that I could lose my life in order to find something better was actually really hopeful. The notion that you could lose this, and, you know, step into something different, that was actually really hopeful for me. And so was the notion that there is a cross. Like in a world that tells you, look, you need to be happy, and life is all about being happy and being comfortable and going on great vacations and living in nice houses and, you know, having these, you know, Facebook picture perfect lives that, you know, everybody's taking the picture of their greatest meal or this meal, right? And how great life is. And when at that moment I was feeling that my life actually was, that there was suffering. I was feeling rejection by the religious institutions that I grew up in. The notion that there is a cross in this world, just the acknowledgement that actually not all of life is happy, not all of life is comfortable, there actually is suffering in the world. We actually do experience abandonment in the world. And that is the cross. Like, that is just part of life. The acknowledgement of that actually, again, was really hopeful for me. Oh, okay. I've got a cross. I know I have a cross. And the invitation is to take it up, not to deny it, not to hide it, but to actually take it up and be authentic in it and follow. Became actually a way out. It became a way of a new possibility. Right? And I think that's why I felt it was hopeful for me in that moment, that I could take up my cross because I was already bearing it. It was just acknowledging that it was there and trotting this path where I would lose my life in order to save it. Each one of you has a cross. Like, I don't know your lives. I don't know all of your lives intimately, but I know enough about life to know that each one of you has a cross. And you suffer because of it. And you fear abandonment because of it, or rejection because of it. And you know that. Maybe your loved ones know that, people who are close to you. But it is unique to you. Our crosses will all be different from each other, but we all have them. And the invitation for the spiritual journey we're on is to take up that cross and follow. Lose that life, right? Lose the life that isn't living. Lose the life that isn't really flourishing. Lose that life of suffering and find a deeper, richer way of being. It doesn't mean that the cross necessarily goes away, but maybe there is this deeper understanding that happens in the midst of it. And I can't say much more than that. Other than welcome to the journey, right? This is the journey we're all on. And I'm glad, actually, that we can be on this journey together. Amen.